The voices of Syrian women are so often underrepresented. Your journey from student activist to award-winning filmmaker has been extraordinary. How do you see your role fitting into the future as a storyteller and an advocate? We have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think we've seen this dream of free Syria 13 years ago, and we thought at some point this will never be happening. Today it is happening. It's real. We have so much work to be done. We have so much lobbying within our community. You know, like, the Syrian people were divided by the Syrian regime for years, and now it's the time to live together, to move forward, to think together, to see this future that's coming together. And this is now the reality of the situation. So yes, so much hope, so much amazing feeling, and our hearts still with everyone who's still waiting for their beloved ones who they were disappeared in Assad prisons for so many years.
And how old is your daughter today?
My daughter now is 9 and my second daughter is 7.
Well, Al-Khatib, I thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning Syrian filmmaker, her film For Sama. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381, or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a person of interest has been arrested in connection to the last week's killing of CEO of United Healthcare.
Oregon State grad students vote on a tentative agreement with management.
And school staff in Washington State push lawmakers to invest in them this upcoming legislative session.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 9th, 2024. I'm Nathan Vandiver.
And I'm Danny Shai. Police have arrested a person of interest in the killing of the United Healthcare CEO in New York City last week. 26-year-old Luigi Mangione was arrested in Pennsylvania after being identified by a witness at a McDonald's. Right now, he's being held on gun charges. Police found a ghost gun and a suppressor on him, plus a 3-page document that could be telling to his motivation. Police say that it seemed Mangione had ill will toward the corporate healthcare system. Mangione also had fake IDs on him, including one used to check into the hostel he stayed at in New York City. Mangione is an Ivy League graduate and software engineer. Internet sleuths have allegedly found his profile on Twitter, and the custom image at the top of the page shows a back x-ray with several rods and pins in the low back. He's scheduled for a preliminary arraignment in Pennsylvania tonight.
Oregon State University graduate student workers will vote on a tentative agreement with the university and potentially end their strike. The Coalition of Graduate Employees, or CGE, represents over 1,700 workers at Oregon State. Hundreds have been on strike since November 12th. KBOO's Rachel Garcia was at a CGE picket late last month. Here is some of what they heard from the workers.
OSU thinks they're unopposed.
Now their greed will be exposed.
OSU thinks they're unopposed.
Now their greed will be exposed.
So my name is Austin Boscraft. I am the president of CGE. I'm also a worker, a graduate worker here at Oregon State University.
Luke Nearhood. I am the vice president for political engagement of CGE and a member of the bargaining team, and I'm a graduate work on the physics department here at Oregon State.
So in terms of how we got here, we began bargaining with the university over a year ago now, and the pace of negotiations at the outset and really through the entirety has been very slow. The university has stalled and stonewalled and drug out negotiations with us. They have failed to give us sufficient financial proposals. They've attempted to lengthen the term of our contract. And so our members have voted to authorize a strike. Our strike began on November 12th. And we are still out here on the line waiting for the university to come to an agreement that we can ratify.
Now, they came into negotiations back in August of 2023 with a very aggressive posture, you know, a tact that we had not seen before in previous bargaining cycles, where initially their lead negotiator was a lawyer from a famously anti-union law firm. The common refrain when it's convenient to the university is that the university is not interested in doing anything beyond what they legally have to do at, like, the bare minimum.
So we can teach and pave the way.
My take-home pay after taxes and everything is about $12,000 a year. Because when I came to Oregon from Arizona as a teacher, I thought things would be slightly better. Oregon State promises this acceptance of diversity, and I just don't see them putting their money where their mouth is.
Not only is the university refusing to increase our wages to a fair wage, they want to lengthen the term of our contract to lock us into low wages.
Ooh.
At the outset of negotiations this year, they proposed a contract which would take us from renegotiating our salary every 2 years to renegotiating every 6 years.
Ooh.
Only after a long-fought battle have we brought them down to every 4 years. The current CGE proposal to the minimum salary will bring the lowest paid workers to a wage which is still below the current average for workers at the present. We are effectively asking OSU to equalize the pay structure for graduate students, not launch our pay to astronomical heights.
And we're doing critical research. We are doing research on things that are really important to our communities, our society, and our planet. There are so many wonderful grads out here that I've talked to that are doing research on climate change, on invasive species, on cancer, on viruses. I myself work on SARS-CoV-2. That is my research. We are all trying to make our world and our communities a better place. And yet OSU thinks we don't deserve to make a livable wage.
Workers have ratcheted up the pressure on the administration in recent weeks with a rally at an event attended by the university president and a sit-in at the president's office. An analysis by the OSU faculty union showed the university is doing well financially and could afford to better compensate grad student workers and faculty. The tentative agreement would lift the lowest paid workers the most. The salary minimum floor would increase around 16% over the 3-year contract. Both sides must ratify the contract before the strike can officially end. If they do, graduate student workers will be back on the job in time for finals week.
School staff in Washington State want lawmakers to invest more in wages and staffing during its upcoming legislative session. They're expressing concern about growing behavioral incidents in classrooms. Eric Tegdoff has more.
Staff members who support schools are calling for greater investment from Washington State. As next year's legislative session approaches, wages and staffing are among the biggest asks in schools among classified staff, employees other than teachers and administrators. Melissa Roach is a peer inclusion preschool paraeducator in Tacoma who works with special education students. She says behavioral incidents are increasing across the board in schools.
We're concerned every day that there could be a serious injury because there's no staffing to get us the appropriate bodies in the room to help us.
Roach says she's seen the most turnover ever in her time as a paraeducator. She says her colleagues have expressed similar concerns. Roach is part of the bargaining team for the Tacoma Federation of Education Support Professionals. Unfortunately for Roach, she says the pay doesn't feel commensurate with the job she's doing, especially as violent behaviors have become worse after the pandemic.
I love my job, but this is the first year that I've ever thought, you know, maybe this isn't for me anymore, and that's heartbreaking to me.
The average starting pay for education support professionals in Tacoma is about $26 per hour. Roach says everyone working in schools is looking for more respect from leaders in the state.
All the things that they're asking for would not happen if it wasn't for the backbone of the system, which is the custodians and the nurses and the paraeducators and all the people who keep things running and clean and healthy behind the scenes.
The 2025 legislative session convenes on January 13th. For Washington News.
A Georgia-based transgender rights activist says a recent Supreme Court case coupled with the re-election of Donald Trump means many of the battles she has faced for acceptance may have to be fought again. Mark Richardson spoke with Monica Helms to learn more.
The issue of transgender rights is back in the news after a recent Supreme Court hearing, and Donald Trump's re-election as president returns those legal and cultural issues to the national conversation. One Georgia-based transgender activist says she fears a new generation of Americans will have to join many of the same battles fought to gain LGBTQ rights. Monica Helms transitioned to live as a woman in the 1990s and says despite many victories over the years, she fears people who are different may always have to fight for acceptance.
It's always going to be a battle. They figure out one thing or another. Trans people have targets on their back. They want to eliminate us from existence. And we've been around since the Roman times.
Helm says she knew as young as age 6 that she was a girl, but did not act on making a change in her life until after 8 years in the U.S. Navy. Soon after, she formed the Transgender American Veterans Association. She's also been an author and activist in the civil rights movement. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week in a case that would uphold a ban on gender-affirming care on children in as many as 25 states. She says a lot of the cultural bias against trans people stems from fear and inaccurate information.
They have a feeling, oh, well, you know, we're predators. We're going to go into bathrooms to look at kids. And it's like, what the heck? You know, if I need to go to the restroom, I go in there to go to the restroom.
Helms may best be remembered as the creator of the first transgender pride flag and being the first openly transgender delegate to the Democratic National Convention. She says the biggest misconception about transgender people is that they elect to be who they are.
That we chose to be who we are, and we didn't choose this. We were born with it. And the fact that we were born with it, many of the scientific organizations, medical organizations, have come to that conclusion.
For Georgia News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
President-elect Trump promises to pardon January 6 rioters on day one. President Biden touts the fall of Syria's Assad regime as an act of justice. And North Carolina Supreme Court recount brings charges of attempted voter suppression. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
People have suffered long and hard, and there may be some exceptions to it. I have to look. But, you know, if somebody was radical, crazy.
President-elect Donald Trump is repeating that on day one, he plans to pardon people convicted for January 6th. In his first sit-down interview since the election, he also doubled down on his immigration plans and vowed to support his controversial cabinet picks. Trump promised not to go after his political opponents, but did say members of the House Select Committee that investigated the insurrection should go to jail. The Syrian government has fallen, ending decades of ruthless Assad family rule. After years of brutal civil war, rebels captured Damascus in a matter of days. President Joe Biden calls the fall of Bashar Assad a fundamental act of justice and a historic opportunity for the people of Syria.
It's also a moment of risk and uncertainty. As we all turn to the question of what comes next, the United States will work with our partners and the stakeholders in Syria.
Assad's allies in Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah have been stuck in other fights and did not send forces to prop him up as they previously had. On social media, Trump is calling for an immediate ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia, citing Russian withdrawal from Syria as a sign of limited capacity. Former Trump National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster says the war in Gaza will continue until Hamas is destroyed. McMaster says the Palestinian group needs to be crushed before any ceasefire, but says he's confident Trump can help make that happen.
So I would like to see us working more actively with the Israelis and others to get the hostages back, but also to make Iran pay the price for their terrorist and proxy network across the region.
Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy's calling for the Democratic Party to broaden its tent while charting a more economically populist direction.
Attacking power is not easy for everybody in the Democratic Party because we have become a party that is dependent on high-income elites.
The race for the North Carolina Supreme Court is still not over. A second recount is expected to finish this week after previous tallies show incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs beating Republican Jefferson Griffin by around 700 votes. Riggs says Griffin's continued challenges could mean throwing out 60,000 legitimate votes.
We should not be weaponizing the systems that exist to defend election mechanisms and election integrity. We shouldn't weaponize it to avoid conceding.
A Georgia-based transgender rights activist says a recent Supreme Court case and Trump's re-election means her many battles for acceptance may have to be fought all over again. Monica Helms transitioned to live as a woman in the 1990s. She fears people who are transgender may always have to fight for acceptance.
It's always going to be a battle. They figure out one thing or another. Trans people have targets on their back.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio with host Michael Gaskill. On this episode, conservation activist and author George Wertner tackles the dominant narrative that forests need active management, like thinning and logging, to save them from wildfire. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with some wind gusts and an overnight low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 46. Today in history, in 1868, the first traffic lights are installed outside of Westminster Palace in London. The first ones looked like railway signals, with flag arms illuminated at night by red and green gas lamps. The quote of the day is from British Czech philosopher Ernest Gellner, who wrote, quote, "It is nationalism which engenders nations and not the other way around."
On average, Native students in the U.S. miss more class than their non-Native peers. One teacher in Oklahoma is working to change that. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Across many parts of the U.S., Native American students miss school at rates higher than the national average. KLCC's Brian Bull talked to one educator in Oklahoma who's worked to bring down absenteeism and truancy in her community.
Holly Youngbear is Cheyenne Arapaho and works as the Watonga School's Indian Education Director.
I retired 2 years ago, but they couldn't find anybody to take my place, so I stepped back in and the school let me come back to work 3 days a week.
Young Bear says her district's absenteeism rate is the lowest in Oklahoma. She says she knows all the families and has come by to pick up absent students from challenging home environments.
Parents who have drug problem or alcohol problems, and they just don't get their kids up on time. I go out to the homes and pick them up, take them to school, just work with the parents to get them to school.
Young Bear adds that the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes also help with school supplies, class fees, and rewarding good grades and attendance. Special programs also help students avoid trouble.
They have Tradition Not Addiction, and they come in and meet with the kids every month and talk about, you know, not smoke or drink or vape.
The tribal jurisdictional area for the Cheyenne Arapaho has generations of families, some who were subjected to the boarding school system. Besides the abuse and attempts at assimilation many encountered, Young Bear says this also may have caused challenges when some boarding school alumni started families.
They never knew how to actually parent when they got out of school. If you don't know how to parent, then you might not want your kids to go to school. It wasn't a priority, I guess you could say.
Young Bear's advice to school administrators who may be dealing with absent Native students is to work with families and try to get counselors or education directors from Indian education backgrounds.
You know, have good grades and lead them on the path to maybe go to college or vo-tech, or, you know, just keep them motivated.
Other challenges that can affect Native American attendance include racism, poverty, or lack of support services. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The state of Washington is helping Native Americans access health care after decades of barriers. Eric Tigetoff has more.
Health insurers have made it difficult for tribal members to get care covered, despite state and federal laws that bar this. Vicki Lowe is head of the American Indian Health Commission, which has led efforts to remove hurdles for Native Americans. She says health insurers would try to make tribal clinics charge out-of-network rates and wouldn't honor their referrals. However, the Washington State Office of the Insurance Commissioner has come out with guidance to prevent this.
Not only will tribes have more money to help pay for services for their tribal members will get care in a more timely manner. So those two things just are really important, and insurance companies have been a barrier for that for decades.
Washington is among the first states to move forward with guidance for insurers and also enforcement of the law so that insurers will stop putting up roadblocks for tribal members to get care in the state. Todd Dixon is the tribal liaison for the Office of the Insurance Commissioner. He says one reason for releasing the guidance was that the agency had seen an uptick in complaints, the number one complaint typically coming from billing managers at clinics.
It says, hey, we have an enrolled member. He or she was seen at our clinic. We billed the insurance company. They said we're out of network, and so we're only paying 60%, and then they send a bill to the enrolled member. It's not how it works.
The insurance commissioner's office has been sending notices to insurers who violate protections for Native Americans. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Antibiotic use in livestock is creeping back up, despite promises to cut back its use in factory farms. Instead, antibiotic use increased, which experts say ultimately makes humans more vulnerable to disease and death from antibiotic resistance. Roz Brown reports.
After a modest decline starting in 2018, sales of antibiotics used to raise U.S. livestock increased more than 4% in 2022, which experts say risks more deaths in people from antibiotic-resistant infections. The American Public Health Association and scientists have described these infections as a growing crisis. Stephen Roach with the group Food Animal Concerns Trust says by species, the latest federal data show 2022 sales of medically important antibiotics for cattle are now higher than any year since 2016.
In pigs in the U.S., it's up by 24%, and in cattle, it's up by 10%. The chicken industry has continued to reduce their use, so it's possible for the animal ag industry to make changes, but we haven't seen that happen in cattle and in pigs.
Broach says from 2017 to 2024, the use of antibiotics in chickens dropped by 50%. Individual farmers may use fewer antibiotics, but about 75% of cattle are raised in large corporate confinements, and that's mostly the meat available at grocery stores. The CDC estimates antibiotic-resistant infections in humans results in 35,000 deaths each year. Roach says his group supports using antimicrobials to treat sick animals or to reduce the risk of infection from one animal to another, but objects to using them to treat healthy animals, a practice prohibited in Europe.
We know we're raising animals in unhealthy conditions, so then we're going to give them antibiotics independent of whether they're diagnosed with an illness.
Roach says the solution to cutting back on antimicrobials is simple. Raise animals in healthy conditions.
Where they're not crowded, where they have healthy diets, and you're not taking the baby pigs from the mother at 3 weeks.
When shopping, Roach encourages folks to look for meat packages labeled no antibiotics, which are sold by food producers who undergo annual on-farm inspections. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. This story was produced using original reporting.
It's that time of year when folks are reminded of how persistent and clever scammers can be when people have a lot of gift buying to do. Experts say common safety tips should still be followed, but there are some newer threats to be on the lookout for. Mike Moen reports on the role cryptocurrency plays in these scams from Nebraska.
If your holiday shopping list is far from complete, consumer advocates in Nebraska hope you don't ignore warning signs of scams and the rush to buy gifts. In a digital world, there are always new things to pay attention to. Over the past few years, shoppers have been warned about avoiding gift card scams or not falling prey to phony texts about a shipment delay. Gina Ragland of AARP Nebraska says the emergence of cryptocurrency in the online trading world presents another challenge, including during the holiday shopping crunch.
Scammers and fraudsters are using the same types of scams that they've used in the past, but they're now soliciting people to pay them through the cryptocurrency ATMs using things such as bitcoins and that.
AARP says if you're directed to send someone money by converting cash to cryptocurrency at a convenience store kiosk, it's a scam. As for other tips, experts note scammers can tamper with gift cards on store racks and steal the funds when the card is activated. They say it's best to ask for a gift card sold behind the counter. They also advise regularly updating software on your electronic devices for additional fraud protection. Ragland says if you get a call from someone initiating a scam about a purchase you never made, asking for a callback number will quickly get their attention.
Typically, you will find if you do ask for a callback number, they're going to hang up on you immediately because they've not gotten what they needed and they wanted and they know you're onto them.
Overall, Ragland says a key thing to remember is if you see an online ad for something that appears too good to be true in terms of price, it's usually a fishy deal. Shoppers also are encouraged to take advantage of tracking information and other shipping supplier services and to schedule deliveries for when you or someone you trust is present to receive them. This is Mike Moen.
Two orphaned 4-month-old mountain lion kittens have found a new home at the Oregon Zoo after being recovered by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Despite the fear that they sometimes invoke, mountain lions play a key role in maintaining healthy Oregon landscapes. Isabel Charlet explains.
People are probably happy to hear that two orphaned mountain lion kittens have been rescued and will find new homes at the Oregon Zoo. But sharing space with them in the wild is a different story. While these kittens are safe, there are different ideas about how much to protect wild mountain lions. Brent Lyles with the Mountain Lion Foundation says although they are often feared, the large cats should be protected for the role they play in maintaining healthy ecosystems.
The carnivores that are at or near the top of the food chain have been shown again and again over the decades to be critically important to the vibrancy and long-term stability of food webs in any environment.
Mountain lions, like other keystone predators, help maintain balance in an ecosystem by controlling herbivore or plant-eating populations, which benefits plant growth and overall biodiversity. Lyle says the deer and elk carcasses they leave behind also provide food for hundreds of other species. However, not everyone is prepared to live in close proximity to mountain lions. By the 1960s, Oregon's cougar population was nearly wiped out. Protections have since allowed their numbers to rebound, but by how much remains unclear. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife permits killing up to 970 cougars annually, a quota some biologists believe is excessive. Lyle says killing too many actually undermines safety, as stable mountain lion populations are less likely to create problems.
Again, it's a very common misconception that the best response to human-wildlife encounter is to get rid of the cougar. Well, if you get rid of it, things can get ugly, and you've just made the community less safe not more safe.
Lyles explains when a dominant lion is removed, multiple young males could move into the territory, prompting more human and livestock encounters. Though these encounters are rare, Lyles says if they happen, you should make yourself look larger and make noise to scare the animal away. Maintain eye contact, avoid running, and back away slowly. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
It's not too late for Portlanders to get a free street tree from the Parks Department of Urban Forestry Team. The Yard Tree Giveaway program closes December 13th. There are around 300 trees still available, meant to increase Portland's tree canopy. The Urban Forestry Team is planting 1,000 more young trees between now and March 2025. They'll be placed near roads, often in the parking strip between the sidewalk and the road. Portland Parks and Recreation Director Adina Long said, quote, "Everyone, regardless of where we live, deserves safer, cleaner, healthier neighborhoods. It's a matter of public well-being. The free street tree program is a step in the right direction," end quote. Priority for these trees is given to areas of northeast and southeast Portland that have far less trees than the west side does. This contributes to markedly hotter weather in these parts of the city, which is a big concern as the city gets more frequent heat waves as a result of climate change. Trees can also improve road safety by enclosing areas and encouraging people to drive slower. Parks and Rec will maintain and water the trees for 3 years after they plant them in neighborhoods like Buckingham, Wilkes, Kenton, and King.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 9th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Rachel Garcia. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Roz Brown, Alex Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9.